I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes today, from allergies to killer diseases, how climate change is making us sicker. But first, those 15 British sailors and Marines who've been held captive in Iran for 13 days are scheduled to board a plane on Thursday and head home.
پیامبر اسلام همه پیامبران قبل از خود را تصدیق کرده است.
At a news conference this morning, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said he released the sailors as a gift to the British people. Also at that news conference, he pinned a medal on the chest of the Iranian Coast Guard commander, who intercepted the British crew last month, in what Iran still believes was Iranian waters. Joining us on the line from London is the previous British ambassador to Iran, Sir Richard Dalton. Sir Richard, first of all, are you surprised by today's news?
A number of us have been saying that Iran might well find that it would gain more by releasing them than by holding on to them and prolonging the affair. And that's indeed what happened. Actually, while his press conference was taking place, I was saying that I didn't rule out an early gesture.
And when you say Iran might gain more, what do you think they have gained?
I think they gained something internally, a feeling that they've confronted the British and shown that they're walking tall. I don't think they've gained anything externally.
Do you think that's true in light of yesterday's news that an Iranian diplomat who'd been seized in Iraq was released, and today's news that the U.S. military says it's considering Iran's request to allow an envoy to visit the Iranians the U.S. took into custody in January in northern Iraq? Is there any sense that there is a quid pro quo, that the British sailors would be in exchange for the Iranians seized in Iraq?
I can't rule that out, but there's no evidence one way or the other. Such evidence as there is points against that. First, the Iranians saying that there was no connection with any other issue, and secondly, President Bush saying that there would be no quid pro quo. But it does seem like a pretty obvious coincidence. Certainly, consular access to the Iranian captives is long overdue. It's been difficult for the UK to call for immediate consular access to our people when there was no access by Iranian officials to those captured by the United States.
How do you think that this incident is going to, if at all, impact Iran's ongoing attempts to have a nuclear program?
It's not relevant to the nuclear dispute in any way.
Not at all.
The view of the international community, including the United States, is that Iran can have a civil nuclear power program, but they have to heed the instructions and warnings and advice and assistance of the International Atomic Energy Agency and the UN Security Council.
Well, I guess, the relevance might be that some were saying that this action actually proved to the world community that Iran is not a stable country, that it might take these kinds of actions and further undermine its claim that it's capable of handling nuclear materials.
Well, frankly, in the long run, the capture for 13 days of British service people will be seen as a very minor incident. The fact is, Iran is, before today's events and after, the same country, namely stable in the short term, with its security forces and its political system in pretty firm control of what goes on. So I don't think this incident has changed the terms of the debate.
And just one last thought. I just want to read back to you some of the things that Ahmadinejad said today and get your thoughts on them. He said, on the occasion of the birthday of the great prophet Muhammad — Muhammad's birthday is March 30th, and for the occasion of the passing of Christ, of course, Easter is coming — I say the Islamic Republic government and the Iranian people, with all powers and legal rights to put the soldiers on trial, forgave those 15. He goes on to ask your Prime Minister Blair not to punish the crew for confessing that they'd been in Iranian waters in those televised accounts. And he criticized Britain for deploying a seaman, that's Faye Turney, who's a woman with a child. He says, how can you justify seeing a mother away from her home, her children? Why don't they respect family values in the West? Your thoughts?
Well, I don't think that Iran is in a strong position, given its policies on many human rights aspects, to criticize Western ways in the matter of family values. That's the first point. Secondly, Iran was bound to put its own spin on its decision to release these people, and nothing that President Ahmadinejad said is out of the ordinary or surprises me.
Sir Richard Dalton, he is the former British ambassador to Iran. Sir Richard, thanks for speaking with us.
Not at all. Thank you.
Well, now to your health and global warming. If you're feeling a little more sneezy than usual this spring, uber allergies are just one of the outcomes cited by a report due out Friday that says climate change could threaten the lives of hundreds of millions of people in the decades to come. Dr. Paul Epstein is Associate Director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. He's reviewed this new report, which comes from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That's the same group that reported earlier this year that human behavior with near certainty is causing global warming. Dr. Epstein, let's start with dengue fever. The report cites a dramatic increase in a deadly type in Mexico. Now, it's also known as bone break fever. It causes excruciating joint pain, high fever. It's usually spread by longer rainy seasons, but tell us how it's spreading in usually dry Mexico.
Dengue fever is carried by Aedes aegypti, which is famous for carrying yellow fever also.
Is someone like you see these outbreaks in Mexico and the border with the U.S.? Are you watching something like that?
We're seeing a northern and southern expansion of the range of Aedes aegypti. It's most marked as it shows up in higher altitudes in the Andes as well. And also, the extreme events are related to the outbreaks. Drought, paradoxically, and where people store water around their houses is associated with large outbreaks in Puerto Rico and Cuba. And now Mexico, too, is experiencing the extremes that breed outbreaks of mosquito-borne diseases.
Well, it's just one of the things you're keeping an eye on. And by the way, officials in Mexico are sending in special teams to, you know, spray pesticides to remove that standing water where mosquitoes breed.
Right.
You've been making these connections for some time between, global warming and diseases. Make it again for us. You know, how, you know, if I drive my car here, how does it cause dengue fever there? What's happening?
Just think carbon dioxide for a moment. Just carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels. The weeds love this stuff. The weeds are taking up carbon dioxide disproportionately, growing fast, and making a lot of pollen.
Giant ragweeds?
Giant ragweeds. And this is an issue for health. It's also for agriculture, because agricultural weeds are getting a foothold. The bugs that eat the leaves are also changing their range and getting a foothold. So there are some of these non-linear impacts, we call them, meaning that it's not just warming, it's bugs, it's weeds, it's pests, it's pathogens, it's extreme weather events that all affect agricultural diseases in this case, but also those are the issues that affect human illness. So just carbon dioxide is having an impact on human health and has implications for allergies and asthma that we hadn't projected just 5 years ago.
Well, if somebody hearing you might say, oh, a few more sniffles, get an allergy medication. What are you talking about that impact being?
Asthma has quadrupled in the United States since 1980. We now are seeing a rise in pollen. We're seeing counts in the thousands in Atlanta and New York and Boston. And so just carbon dioxide's impact on plants and weedy plants may be part of the explanation.
Well, just this week we hear a Texas congressman, Republican Joe Barton, and this is after the Supreme Court ordered the Bush administration to take another look at global warming. He said global warming will actually benefit more people than it might hurt. There will be longer growing seasons. Some areas that were freezing will be warmer and more livable. And so his take on it was that parts of the world might actually fare better.
Unfortunately, this is very linear and hopeful thinking that we're seeing already contradictions to. Weather variability is a key part of climate change, and the instability of weather is now being studied by the EPA, looking at motor vehicle accidents in the winter, looking at orthopedic accidents. This is also true in the summer with heat waves. It's the variability of weather, the instability that may have more to do with our defenses and direct injuries than the actual temperature.
Well, you know, I'm thinking in addition, Andrew Revkin wrote in the New York Times this week that many people are saying that, yes, some areas might fare better than others, but in fact it's the least industrialized countries that are going to fare the worst. The ones who produce the least global warming are going to fare the worst. And in fact, the richer nations have an obligation to help those
right.
countries. It's sort of a, you know, the polluter should pay.
It's clear that underdeveloped nations are getting the brunt of this. For Africa, the prognosis is dire. There's a whole report on Africa showing that projecting intensifying droughts We're now seeing flooding in parts where there were droughts. There's Rift Valley fever. There's malaria. There's cholera. So the whole cluster of illnesses in the wake of flooding, in addition to deaths and displacement of populations. But no nation is immune. We're now seeing changes in the Atlantic Ocean, the North Atlantic, that are affecting weather in Europe and the U.S., and we're seeing changes in the Pacific that are affecting Japan. In fact, the insured losses in the last few years have been overwhelmingly due to storms in the Northern Hemisphere. And while back in the 90s, we were seeing Hurricane Mitch in Honduras and Mozambique floods and Venezuela storms, we're now seeing Hurricane Katrina, windstorms into Europe. So we're all actually vulnerable to the variability of weather. And that's what's having the greatest impact on our health, our agriculture, and our economic systems.
What diseases are you seeing in places that you didn't have them before?
We're seeing in the highlands of Africa, Latin America, Asia, where glaciers are retreating, plant communities are migrating upward, and mosquito-borne diseases are circulating. Nairobi, for instance, is a mile-high city, and it has malaria now. And this is true for the highlands of Africa, all the way from Ethiopia through Burundi and Rwanda down to Zimbabwe and South Africa.
Because it should be too cold because it's mile high. Is that
exactly,
what you're saying?
Exactly, and that's
why
the
mosquitoes are there.
White folks who colonized Africa 150 years ago went to the highlands to escape the mal areas, the bad areas, where the swamps that bred diseases.
You've mentioned Rift Valley fever?
Rift Valley fever affects humans, but it also affects sheep, goats, and cattle. So in East Africa right now, it's affecting people's nutrition, livelihoods, ability to trade animals. So there are really strong economic, agricultural, and health impacts from Rift Valley fever. It's nasty.
And it's jumped from Africa to Saudi Arabia.
And we're seeing a number of diseases do that. There's another one from around Kenya that appeared during the drought called chikungunya fever. It's broken out in Kenya and in Reunion, Seychelles, and Comoros, again related to drought from 2004-2006. And it, too, has jumped around the Indian Ocean to Sri Lanka, India, and now Indonesia, and even out to the Philippines. It's affecting tourism. It's affecting our health. It's another one related to the extremes, in this case, drought.
Dr. Paul Epstein, infectious disease specialist, on a new report coming this Friday saying global warming is increasing illness. We're going to have more with Paul. And this programming note, later on Here and Now, an incredible claim by an investigative reporter and several U.S. soldiers that the military is misdiagnosing thousands of injured combat vets, saying they have a pre-existing condition called personality disorder, in order to deny them benefits and treatment and save the military money. That's later. Back with more from Dr. Paul Epstein after a quick break Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Dr. Paul Epstein, Associate Director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School, in advance of Friday's report on the health effects of global warming. The report predicts that within 25 years, hunger from crop failure and death from diarrhea caused by foul drinking water will threaten to collapse countries with droughts caused by climate change. Dr. Epstein, I want to talk to you about some of the strategies for turning all this around. But first, there are critics who say you're making oversimplifications. There's always been drought. And drawing the connection between global warming and human diseases, they say, is wrong. I mean, for instance, we have globalization, they say. More people are traveling, carrying diseases with them. You say what?
These are false arguments. Mm-hmm. No one is saying it's all climate. There are multiple stresses on our environment. We're very comfortable in epidemiology and public health of looking at multiple issues that lead to a consequence. But as we see the climate changing and becoming more unstable, it's becoming a stronger force in outbreaks and in the spread of infectious diseases.
Okay, so what do we do?
there's a whole suite of issues that we should be doing right now that are no regrets, meaning they're good for public health, they'll help create jobs, and they help with climate stabilization.
You're talking about things like capping fuel emissions, fixing coal-fired plants, things like
well,
that?
Well, before we even get to the fossil fuel-related issues, we're talking about CAFE standards for cars.
Higher, corporate average, more mileage from cars.
Right, yep. Corporate mm-hmm. average fuel efficiency, more mileage from cars. That's plug-in hybrids. There's a group at MIT that's making a battery that said they could get 165 miles per gallon.
But, Doctor, you're an infectious disease specialist, and you've suddenly found yourself a climate specialist. Aside from the energy-saving procedures that we've been talking about, is there anything infectious disease specialists are talking about?
I'm trained in tropical public health and worked overseas in Africa, so I've seen the importance of latrines and clean water sanitation and energy.
It's all connected.
It's all connected. And here what we're looking at now is turning the tables and saying public health has to be front and center goal of development. Back in the 1800s, when TB, cholera, and smallpox broke out in the cities of Dickensian England, paved streets, sanitation, clean water, less crowding became the reason for development. We're saying there's a climate crisis today. The energy issue is the first and necessary, though insufficient, step towards sustainable development. This is the way we have to clean up, and we, as a public health community, have to weigh in on the importance of that as well as making the right choices. There are many futures we can imagine, but there's only one that's going to actually happen. We've got to get this one right, and it's got to be healthy, ecologically sound, and economically feasible.
So you're saying you don't build something, whether it's a building or a road, or you don't propose something without thinking its health consequences first.
Exactly. Green buildings gets us a long way towards this, and it pushes green chemistry, sustainable forestry, and clean energy.
Green buildings being, building things without products that emit poisonous gases, planting grasses on roofs, things like this.
You got it. And yeah. Non-petrol-based chemicals that are carcinogens for pesticides, fertilizers, paints, carpets, all these can be made with biodegradable. And we're seeing DuPont and Dow chemicals start to go towards this because natural gas and petrol have actually gone up so much in the last few years. So we're seeing a shift to this green chemistry and the clean energy and sustainable forestry and green buildings, rooftop gardens, bike lane streets, walking, all this is part of the solutions.
I'm smiling because there was a report this week on the Today Show about the high incidence of allergies caused by global warming. They did the entire report about more pollen, about people really suffering. And then at the end they said, and experts say the solutions are, wash your body and your hair before you go to sleep at night, wash out the pollen. There were some other solutions. And turn on that air conditioning. So you're going to have those kinds of collisions, aren't you? I mean, to feel better, people in highly industrialized countries are going to do more of the very things that cause the problem.
These collisions, this is a micro, here's a macro. In Peru, where they're losing glaciers and hydropower, they're making plans for coal-fired plants. This is going to play out in many ways. Our defenses become our enemies and worsen the problem, which is why we need to think upstream and change our energy pattern. And just to come back to that, it's the clean energy issues that are fundamental. Energy generated near the point of use protects against storms and blackouts, heat waves and blackouts. It provides energy in the underdeveloped areas for pumping water, irrigating land, cooking, indoor respiratory disease from cooking being a major problem in underdeveloped areas. It can light up homes and clinics and drive small businesses. In other words, health, agriculture, and development all require energy. Energy and water are the key to health. That improves your coping mechanisms. It also drives the new technologies to power our society.
Using solar, using wind, using things that are, as you say, local, is not only better and because you will have the energy, but it's more healthy.
Indeed. In Boston, we have geothermal heat pumps that are fabulous. After 7 years, they're payback. They're free for heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. all of these things, we have the technologies today, and we could be reducing our emissions significantly.
You mentioned that there was another time in our history when there was this effort to stop an environmental health problem, when people realized that you couldn't have waste in the, running in the streets, that you had to have clean water, and right. they began building that way. And they did. Do you have that hope now, that that change will be made?
I do have the hope. I think that we're seeing now in the Supreme Court a decision. We're seeing on Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Swiss Re, large investors all lining up saying, regulate us. We need a price of carbon. We need the incentives to move ahead. And with the right kind of economic incentives, we can make this a win-win-win for the economy, the energy system, and the environment.
And the health. Dr. Paul Epstein, Associate Director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School, in advance of this week's report on the health aspects of global warming. Dr. Epstein, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, still ahead. Soldiers with shrapnel wounds told they have a pre-existing condition that denies them benefits. How could that be? That's after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. According to the U.S. Defense Department, in the last 6 years, the Army alone has discharged more than 5,500 soldiers for personality disorders. It's called Regulation 635-200, Chapter 513, Separation Because of Personality Disorder. In fact, across the entire military, thousands have been discharged with the same diagnosis, even if they have other combat injuries. Well, according to reporter Joshua Kors, this is a way for the military to cut costs, because the Department of Veteran Affairs doesn't have to provide care or disability pay to soldiers with personality disorders, because it's considered a pre-existing condition. Joshua writes in the current issue of The Nation magazine, his story is entitled How Specialist Town Lost His Benefits, and Joshua joins us with more. Welcome.
Good to be with you, Robin.
First, let's tell John Town's story. This is Army Specialist John Town, a 20-something, injured in 2004 in Ramadi, Iraq, when a rocket landed near him. He had shrapnel in his neck. His ears were bleeding. I mean, there is no debate that he was injured that day.
No, no doubt about it. He was left largely deaf by the rocket attack, and the military recognized his wounds by giving him a Purple Heart. But when it came time to discharge him, the Army decided that his deafness was actually caused by a pre-existing personality disorder, and by doing that, they could discharge him without ever paying him disability or medical benefits for the rest of his life.
I have to stop. This, you know, in reading this, it sounds incredible. Hearing it from you, it sounds even more incredible. On what basis? I mean, did his family say that he had any deafness prior to his injury?
No. In fact, in all of the cases I looked at during my 6 months of researching the personality disorder discharges, never once did they interview any of the family or friends or fellow soldiers who could have testified to both the health and proper performance, outstanding performance in John's case. He had won 12 medals before the rocket assault. In the case of William Woolridge, they diagnosed him as having a personality disorder within 30 minutes. But Robin, to put this in perspective, the importance of John's case and William's case is that they're not alone. Across the entire armed forces, in just the last 6 years, 22,500 soldiers have been discharged with personality disorder. Cheating those veterans out of their benefits saves the Army $12.5 billion over the course of their lifetime. That's $8 billion in disability pay, $4.5 billion in medical care.
Let me hold you up right there and ask some of the questions that are raised by this. First of all, how does a soldier get into the service if he has personality disorder? Aren't they screened when they enlist?
Well, that's the absurdity of these diagnoses. Soldiers are actually screened twice before serving in Iraq, once when they join the military, and a second time before deployment. Reviewing the medical records in all of these cases, these are perfectly healthy soldiers according to the Army's own medical documents. It's only when they return wounded that the pre-existing personality disorder is discovered.
And what does the military say to soldiers who question this? For instance, to soldiers who say, but I never had anything prior to this. What's the response?
You know, I'm investigating a case right now of precisely that scenario. A soldier who had the lens of his eyeball damaged during combat in Iraq. He was viewed by a doctor at Fort Carson, Colorado, same fort where John Towne served. And the doctor told him flat out, look, you don't have a personality disorder, but I'm going to diagnose you with it anyway. It'll get you out fast, and you'll get to keep your benefits. And when he said, no, I won't get VA benefits and medical care, the doctor became enraged and kicked him out of the office.
You also cite another case where the military told a soldier, well, this personality disorder that you had was lying dormant, and it was unleashed by your injury. All of this begs the question, how could this be happening? How could doctors, why would doctors knowingly deny soldiers their benefits and disability pay? What reasons did you find that doctors would want to do this?
Well, you know, first of all, the dormant argument is an important point. I spoke with a professor of psychiatry who has been writing about these issues and treating veterans for over 20 years. He just wrote a book called Courage After Fire. And he pointed out to me that that's just simply not how personality disorder works. It can't lay dormant and be triggered by definition. So that argument for the medical community will recognize that as flatly false.
Well, to the other point, why would so many doctors examining these soldiers give them a misdiagnosis of personality disorder knowing that they'd be losing their benefits?
First of all, there's $12.5 billion in savings for this. So the larger army has a great motive to push for these misdiagnoses. But on the doctor's level alone, there's a tremendous encouragement as well. The hospitals at these bases are simply overrun. And with the personality disorder discharge, you can get the soldier out the door in 5 days. Doing that frees up a bed that is waiting for the 3 or 4 soldiers who need it.
Whereas if they're putting in for a disability pay, they have to wait and go before a medical board, and it's very time-consuming.
It takes about 6 months.
But why else? Why else would this happen? Because, you know, reading the stories of how these soldiers are impacted, they're home, they have no medical treatment, no coverage, they seem very disabled, and even in some cases they've had to give back their enlistment bonuses, so they're in debt.
That's right. Part of the personality disorder discharge means that each of the wounded veterans has to give back their signing bonus so that on the day of their discharge, many of these injured soldiers find out they actually owe the Army several thousand dollars.
But again, the question is why, and you write about the money that's saved, but you also write that commanders sometimes want to get these guys who are disabled, they're not functioning to their top ability, they want to get them out the door because then they can get another soldier in their place.
That's another key motivation. You have hobbled soldiers who come back from Iraq not functioning fully. If the troop is going to be returning to Iraq, they need tip-top soldiers to take their place. One way to get them out quickly and replace them fast is by falsely diagnosing them with personality disorder.
That's Joshua Kors. His article on injured U.S. troops diagnosed with personality disorders, even if they felt they didn't have this pre-existing condition, and then discharged without benefits. His article appears in this current edition of The Nation magazine. And we want to note, many of the troops told Joshua they were assured they would keep their benefits if they accepted that diagnosis. Kors asked the head of the Department of Behavioral Health at Evans Army Hospital at Fort Carson in Colorado, Colonel Stephen Knorr, if doctors were assuring patients they would keep their benefits once diagnosed with a personality disorder. Colonel Knorr replied that he didn't believe that these doctors were doing that. He also said he was confident Army doctors were properly diagnosing the soldiers in question. We'll continue to follow this story. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here Now. There's a new record today for how fast a conventional train can go, and it belongs to France. With a 25,000-horsepower engine and special wheels that provide perfect contact with the track, the TGV, or Train à Grande Vitesse V150, hit 357.2 miles per hour as it flashed through the French countryside on a 15-minute run from Paris to Strasbourg yesterday. On board the record-setting ride, Fiona Ma. She represents part of the San Francisco Bay Area in the California legislature and has been a big backer of a proposal to bring high-speed rail to her state. So, Fiona, who joins us now from Paris after your ride yesterday, what did it feel like yesterday?
Well, at its top speed, it was twice as fast as a commercial jet taking off on the runway.
Did you feel it in your body?
Oh, yeah, you did feel it. The countryside was flying by us, but you can feel kind of the pressure and the force on your body. Mm-hmm. You know, you definitely had to stay in your seat. My arms were clenched on the seat rails, and it was a little scary going that fast.
Well, as we said, this was just to break that record. The regular speed is about 200, and we should say that the train came short of the ultimate train speed record. That was set by a Japanese magnetic levitation, or maglev, train in 2003. The maglev train, it doesn't have wheels. It levitates above a steel rail while electromagnetics attached to the bottom of the train keep it on course. Your train had special wheels, special treatment of the rails to keep the train on the rails, special banking. Overall, did you come away from the trip still in favor of having high-speed rail in California?
Oh, yeah. I think people are sick and tired of sitting in their cars, tired of going to the airports, not knowing whether they're going to make their flights and their meetings. And high-speed rail offers, you know, safety. It is comfortable, reliable, and it also is better for the environment. With all the focus now on global warming, this is the cleanest alternative in terms of transportation, and no other single project can reduce CO2 emissions by it's estimated 12.4 billion pounds per year.
Well, we understand that California has the second largest number of rail passengers in America behind New York, which we found interesting. So people obviously want to ride the rails. There is a $10 million bond measure that's supposed to be on California's 2008 ballot. Would provide half of funding for about a 700-mile high-speed rail line. Your governor, though, is against this.
Well, I don't think he is so much against it, but there are just so many competing interests right now for money, and so part of the reason we're here is to look at other financing options, other ways that we can pay for this system. That is what we are looking at right now.
Do you have any concerns about safety? You mentioned that there, you know, you feel that the line is safe, but there was a terrible accident in Germany in 1998 with a high-speed train that killed 100. And in looking at the pictures of yesterday's run, it didn't seem that the train was fenced in. You know, there was nothing between people standing on the grass and the train going by. Won't more people, animals, cars be hit by these trains that you can hardly see coming because they're going so fast?
Well, I think that's always a concern. But France, as well as Japan, they have never had one casualty on their high-speed rail system due to their own fault.
We understand next month you're going to convene the High-Speed Rail Caucus. This is a bipartisan effort.
Correct.
To get your project launched. What do you envision, ultimately? In Europe, there are package deals with rail lines and airlines offering fast trains from Brussels, for example, to take you to Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris. What do you envision in California?
I mean, ultimately, in the next 20 years, I envision being able to get on a train in San Diego and go all the way up to Sacramento.
How long would that trip take now, and how long do you expect it to take with high rail?
Well, I'll just give you from Los Angeles to San Francisco. It's probably a six-hour drive by car. By high-speed rail at 200 miles per hour, it would be 2.5 hours.
Hmm.
So significantly less time. More comfortable for the rider. You know, people can get on their laptop or make phone calls, have meetings while they're driving, and be at point A, point B within a certain amount of time.
Fiona Ma, assemblywoman in the California legislature, who's in Paris right now because she was on that high-speed train yesterday that broke the record for conventional train speed. That was in France. And she's looking to bring this kind of high-speed train to California. Fiona, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, after a quick break, author Gish Jen on The American Dream as seen by American novelists. Here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It's the American dream to come up from nothing. Ben Franklin, born in Boston, arrived in Philadelphia with just 3 cents in his pocket and spent it all on 3 loaves of bread. And still, he ended up a founding father of this country. But as a new public television special points out, for almost as long as there's been an American dream, a sort of American secular religion, there have been American writers calling attention to its dark underbelly, to the lie that lives with the promise. The special is called Novel Reflections on the American Dream. It features 7 writers from the 20th century, from F. Scott Fitzgerald to Edith Wharton to Gish Jen, who joins us now in the studio. She's the author of 1991's Typical American, the immigrant story of Ralph Chang from China. And Gish joins us with more. Gish, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
This special is such a great way to look at novels. The show uses photos, reenactments. In the case of telling the story of your book, they use fake home movies that look real. It shows us how so many great American stories are either connected to each other or diverge from each other. You talk right at the top of the introduction of your story about the story of Ben Franklin and having thoughts about maybe that's not applicable to everybody.
Well, of course, you know, Ben Franklin arrives in Philadelphia at kind of a wonderful moment in American history. The country is open to him. All possibilities are open to him.
Because he's a white male.
Because he's a white male, you know. As a writer, I'm writing in 1986, you know, the very first barrier to anyone being able to achieve the American dream is first establishing your Americanness. You know, so Typical American is a book that's very much concerned with redefining Americanness to begin with, you know. I'm writing at a time when, you know, it's still popularly held that an American is someone who eats apple pie and is grown up on a farm. You know, so even before I get to the starting gate, you know, I'm very much concerned with, is that the definition anymore? And can we maybe more usefully think about an American as someone who's preoccupied with identity? So, you know, in this book, I try to advance the idea that perhaps as soon as you start asking that question, what does it mean to be Iranian American, Chinese American, Irish American, you are American.
Let's listen to a little of the actress Ming-Na. Listeners might remember her from ER or The Joy Luck Club. Here she's reading from Novel Reflections on the American Dream from your novel.
It's an American story. Before he was a thinker or a doer or an engineer, much less an imagineer like his self-made millionaire friend Grover Ding, Ralph Chang was just a small boy in China, struggling to grow up his father's son.
Gish Jang, that gives us a little taste of the character we meet in your novel, yes. Ralph Chang, and his friend, Grover Ding. Others compare them to the great Gatsby and his friend Nick Carraway. Who was Ralph Chang to you?
Ralph Chang, to me, first and foremost, is, you know, is an immigrant. He's not even aware that there is an American dream, really. Mm. You know, this business of his being his father's son. When he comes to this country, he is still on the old world model. So he is trying to, you know, be not what he wants to be, but to be what he's supposed to be.
And in fact, his first views of Americans, he thinks they're awfully wasteful and he doesn't really understand them.
Yeah, of course. He looks around, he thinks, oh my God, you know, typical American wasteful, typical American lazy. It is one of the ironies of the book, of course, that by the end of the book, he's someone that we might consider typical American. But part of this book is about coming to the American dream from the outside. So not even knowing what it is, kind of having it dawn on you, and then how I'm discovering the limits of the dream.
Right. At one point, it's explained through a meal at a diner, at least he could take the impression from a meal at a diner, that the American dream is eating all you want. Let's listen to a scene where Ralph is brought to a diner by his new friend, Grover Ding. He's a third or fourth generation American and very expansive, feels a lot like the Gatsby relationship to Nick Carraway. Here, Ralph orders just a plain hamburger. But Grover says, oh, no, you've got options. This is America. Let's listen.
Grover reached across the table and removed the top half of its bun. Nobody, he said, eats a burger naked. He piled on top ketchup, mustard, relish, a tomato slice from his own cheeseburger super deluxe, a few rings of onion, 5 French fries. That's good, Ralph said. And when Grover ordered a black and white ice cream soda, Ralph shyly did too.
What were you saying in that scene in the diner about Ralph and how much he's eating?
Well, he's discovering that, you know, America is a place where it's all right to have a gigantic appetite. You know, it's all right to think, you know, this is what I want. This is what, you know what I mean? There's a sense of It's about satisfying your own desires and your own wants.
Yeah. I'm just so struck, having watched all of these stories in a row, which is one of the benefits of the show, as how they relate to each other. Your character, Ralph Chang, has a list of self-improvement, and so did Gatsby. So did Ben Franklin.
Right. And, of course, I was thinking about those lists when I, you know.
Were you?
Well, yes, of course. You know, it's not possible to write a list like that without thinking about the other lists. So Ralph seems to have some kind of vague idea that this is what you do when you go to America, you know what I mean, some vague ideas about self-improvement. But, of course, his list is kind of, you know, it kind of peters out at number six, you know. You know, it was mostly focused on, you know, I shouldn't keep on eating when others have stopped.
Right.
Know?
I will pay no attention to girls.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? It is and it isn't Ben Franklin's list.
You actually said it's an anti-list. What do you mean by that?
He seems to have some vague idea of what Ben Franklin's list would be, or that this is the mold that he's supposed to be assuming. But in fact, he doesn't really understand the mold.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, he makes a choice. He gets his PhD, he gets a good job, he gets a wife and a family. But then he opens a fast food restaurant, he overreaches, he fails, his restaurant closes, his house has to be sold. So what are you saying there about the American dream?
Well, he does find freedom here. He does find much more freedom than he would have had in China. But he still has his own limits to contend with. So I guess that's to say that he comes to America and he does discover himself. But he discovers he is maybe not the person that he would have wanted to be. But the problem isn't America. The problem is him.
That America may still be limitless, but people have limits.
People have limits. People have limits.
And they make pacts with the American dream can suddenly contort into the devil, you know, when you make certain pacts. And that theme is running through the other books as well. I'm thinking Edith Wharton's The House of Mirth, Lily Bart, the characters who doesn't understand that the man who's giving her money wants something in return. Sister Carrie from Theodore Dreiser's Sister Carrie in Chicago also makes some deals, not understanding what the payoff is. I mean, sometimes the American dream wants something back that you may not be able to give up or want to give up.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and sometimes the problem is society, but sometimes the problem is us, you know? Several times in this novel, I refer to, you know, the wilderness of freedoms. And I think that in this case, the problem is his own vision, I guess. There are limits to his own vision of what to do with all that freedom.
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm wondering if Ralph Chang was too limited in his notion of what success is, because the last images are of two of his friends who are sitting in cheap little plastic swimming pools on rafts, and they're in love. Did he miss that?
Yes, he did miss that. You know, one of my aims in this book had been to sort of complicate our ideas about the American dream, because I think, of course, when we first hear that phrase, we think it's about success. You know, we think the American dream is about making it. But actually, I think from the beginning, you know, the American dream has also been about love. You know, it's been about free love. And so, you know, I kind of have two tracks going in this book. One is the success track that Ralph is on. It doesn't go so well for him. But his sister, Teresa, actually finds something in America that she never would have found in the old world. And that is, she finds love.
Gish Jen's novel is Typical American. It's part of this terrific special, one of seven books featured on Novel Reflections on the American Dream. Gish Jen, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And to find out where to see Novel Reflections on the American Dream in your area, go to our website. You can also go there to hear Gish Jen read from Typical American. That's here-now.org for both. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.